cattle and pigs were processed than anywhere else in the world, well into the 20th century. If you, those of you from the States, if you read the book The Jungle as you were, when you were kids, you know what I'm talking about. Because all these facilities kind of had one thing in common. Anything they didn't need, they threw right into the river. Additionally, Chicago grew a lot in the 19th century, going from 3,000 people in the 1830s to 1.2 million in the 1890s. It was the fastest growing city in the world. Of course, there wasn't much of a sewage system, so often when there was a good rain, raw sewage would come into the Chicago River as well, making it a pretty polluted river, and that was the problem. Because as I
ben,
told
can you photograph
as it
that
was
ship
a river
for me?
That went into Lake Michigan,
no?
That's where
okay.
the drinking water for the city
just
came
want to
from,
get the word
in
is free.
And after big rains, they discovered that the incidence of waterborne illnesses, you know, typhoid, cholera,
thanks.
Went way up. In fact, so they kept going out further and further to collect the lake water, but became problematic. So in 1888, city decided, okay, we've got to come up with a solution. We're going to start this organization called the Chicago Sanitary District. Told them to figure it out. And what they decided to do was they dug a canal, a different canal, about 9 miles south of here. And it's very deep, it goes down to bedrock, and is 23 miles long, again, to hook up with the Illinois River. It took 8 years to dig this canal. It was a big endeavor indeed. The doors of that canal opened January 1900. And when it first opened, you know, the water from the South Branch slowly started to trickle into this canal. And over the next couple of weeks, that trickle became stronger and stronger, you know. Just gravity pulling that water into that canal until, as they had hoped or expected to happen, one day they discovered that the Chicago River no longer flowed into Lake Michigan. It now flowed away from Lake Michigan, down the South Branch of the river, into this canal, hooked up with the Illinois River, onto St. Louis and the Mississippi. And after those first couple of rains, hey, the drinking water remained much cleaner. Ah, victory. But as you can imagine, this was a less than popular scheme if maybe you lived in St. Louis, right? Because one day you're on this really nice river, and the next day everything Chicago doesn't want is headed your way. Huh? And that's figuratively and literally everything Chicago didn't want. They tried a number of times to get Chicago to stop digging, but were never able to get an injunction that stuck. So to this day, the river does flow backwards still. But Chicago has spent the last 116 years or so trying to keep the water as clean as possible. You know, new regulations for those industrial and commercial entities, and of course, big improvements to our sewage system. But, you know, like any big municipal project, sometimes it's 5 steps forward, half a step, or a full step backwards, you know? But it's still something Chicago works on a lot. And I often think, imagine in the 1890s, right? Electricity was just coming to bear. And telephones were a new phenomenon. But you talk to someone at a cocktail party and said, what are you doing at work? And they said, well, I'm changing the course of the Chicago River. I mean, that's pretty bold plan, and despite our misgivings about it at this point in time, it really did help us solve that problem. So we're going right now under a couple of bridges named for an early Chicago settler, King John Kinsey. First, it's the Kinsey Street Bridge, very popular for wedding photographs, as you can see, a nice view into the city. And then the Kinsey Street Railroad Bridge, which is permanently up, the only bridge that's permanently up right now, but you get a good chance to see what is here, the exposed counterweight that is used to hold up that bridge. It's kind of painted a yellowy green color. That counterweight, in general, they have to weigh about 3 times the weight of the bridge that they're pulling up. But they put this bridge down once a year to just to inspect it, but in general, the railroads don't go to that part of the city anymore. Now, as we go to the over the main branch again, the captain's going to take us down the South Branch of the river. And I want to point out here on the right-hand side the fact that until we turned around, all the buildings here on the right-hand side have had to deal with the railroad tracks in one way or another. You know, railroad tracks were here long before there were any buildings, even before a building was a glimmer in an architect's eye. Next coming up, this building over the white decking, this is called River Point. It'll be completed next year, designed by Picard Chilton. So here they put a big deck over the railroad tracks. You know, they buy the air rights from the railroads, and then pieces of land in between the tracks for vertical support. So they put this decking over. It'll be landscaped soon, sort of like a little park. And then the building itself is just barely past the tracks, this particular building. You notice it's got a little curve at the front. They put that curve in predominantly to accommodate for the possibility of some new railroad tracks that are going to be put down there for a hot, new high-speed line. You know, it's something that would be nice to have here. But again, you see here in the deck, the portholes with the fans, because again, there's often trains sitting here. If you quickly look over to the left-hand side, you see the reflection here in that curved green glass building, 333 West WAC. That's why so many people love this building. It's a bit, often when they pull Chicagoans, that's their favorite building. So, here in the bow of the boat now on the left-hand side, as we come out from the bridge, you'll see a building that really has a good idea of what Chicago looked like in the beginning of the 20th century. It's called the Great Lakes Building. Red brick covered in ivy with some nice ginkgo trees in front. It's from 1914, designed by Holabird and Roche. It's what we call an expressed frame, right? Anywhere that there is brick, it's covering up a steel frame. And then there are windows, so you know exactly here the frame is expressed. You know exactly how many floors the building has. As opposed to newer buildings that are all covered in glass, you really have no way of knowing what the frame is like. Now, into the 1960s, Chicago was still not building a lot of tall buildings, right? After the Depression and World War II, things were slow to get going again. And next on the left, we'll see a building, now called General Grove Properties, designed by Graham Anderson Probst and White. But what they lack in height, what it lacks in height, it makes up for in a very elegant touch. Again, 1962. Look at this building with the fluted stainless steel, kind of a ribbon of stainless steel in between each window. This would have been the first time stainless steel would have been used on the exterior of the building. And again, it's not a tall building, but it's got this very elegant touch, very prestigious, because in fact, this was built as the headquarters for the Morton Salt Company. On the other side of the bridge, that same firm, Graham Anderson Probst and White, designed that building. It's from 1929. You see it's written in stone there. It's the Civic Opera Building.
Will you photograph the name? I've run out. I've got no more charge of the opera.
Not,
just the opera.
Clad in limestone. Also working under that 1923 regulation, but here it doesn't look like a throne. It actually looks like a sofa, because behind this blank limestone wall is the backstage area for a 3,500 seat opera theater. And the idea was that this building, the theater with the office building surrounding it, the rents from that office building were supposed to help financially support the opera theater. The only problem was that the first performance here was October 1929, virtually 1 week after the Great Market Crash, starting the Great Depression. And of course, most of those companies no longer were in business. So it was a great financial disaster for all of the investors in that building. But we're lucky it still actually operates as the Chicago Lyric Opera of Chicago, very successful firm. Company. So as we come out from under the bridge, you see two buildings, a couple of twins on the right-hand side. Gateway Center 1 and what was originally Gateway Center 2, now called CDW Plaza. First thing you notice, this building is built right over the railroad tracks, right? All its vertical supports staggered in between the tracks. These are predominantly metro trains that go out to the suburbs. But the style of this building, these buildings is mid-century modern, designed by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, and completed in the mid-1960s. Now, many of the principals, original members or principals of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, had been students of a gentleman named Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, who came to Chicago from Germany just before World War II. Mies' idea, less is more, I think you've heard of that, that a building should be stripped down to its bare essence. Just the frame and the material covering it. No ornamentation at all. Inside, universal space. A very cost-effective building that, again, people can subdivide any way they want. And it was very popular all over the world, but particularly here in the Midwest, this mid-century modern style. But people kind of tired of it. It is a kind of an austere kind of design. Some people might even think it's cold. So things started to change. Here on the right-hand side, you see another building that in this Gateway series. It's now called Fifth Third Bank Plaza. Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill designed it. It was completed in the early 1970s. First thing you notice is this building no longer has steel on the exterior. There's concrete there. And covering
Chicago Police.
And, you know, I think you would have to think that concrete.
Going down the left-hand side.
Texture
that was that noise.
That is added via the concrete is kind of a form of ornamentation. Additionally, there's this little bustle, this small building attached to it with the X bracing on the outside. That is because originally this building was the headquarters for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And that little building with that all that structure on the outside means that the inside is relatively free, is free of columns, because the Mercantile Exchange, they originally used hand signals to do their trading. Mostly futures, you know, foreign currencies, things like that. Now, Gateway Center 4 is right here on the right-hand side. From the early 1980s, again, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, first thing, it's no longer a rectangle. There's a little curve because it's contextual to the curve that the river takes right here. And then we've got those sort of pillowed glass. Each frame of glass is pinched at the corner, making kind of a pillow. But when you look at them all together, it's very much like the surface of the river below it, that sort of twinkling eye. So between all our mail order companies and the Federal Reserve Bank and Encyclopedia Britannica, Chicago needed a really big post office. And here on the right-hand side is the old central post office. The center portion is from 1922, and the tower's about 10 years later, the surrounding towers. Another design by Graham Anderson, Probst & White, and has, again, that Art Deco sort of look, right? The windows are darkened and recessed, all the ornament very flat. If you look at the bridge ahead of us, you realize that the roadway for that bridge goes right through the center of the building. They knew when they were designing it that there were plans for a wide boulevard that would go out to the west here. It took about 25 years after the building was completed before the roadway was done, but they had the hole all ready for them to go right through the building. And in fact, it turned out that it was no longer a boulevard. We're just going underneath the entrance and exit ramps for the Eisenhower Expressway 290, part of our interstate system that goes well out to the west here. Now, unfortunately, this building has been empty since 1996 when the Postal Service closed it because it was very much out of date. And sadly, it has been empty ever since. It's been owned by a number of companies over the years. But just recently, it was sold to a New York development firm. They promised that within a couple of years, there will be adaptively reused offices within this building. The city is very keen for this to happen sooner rather than later, so I think they're going to really hold their feet to the fire to make sure it happens. Because 20 years is a long time for a big building like that to be empty. Of course, needed a new post office, and that's what we have here on the right, the new post office. 1996, designed by Knight engineers, architects, and planners. You notice they don't have a river walk because, you know, I guess the federal government didn't have to go along with that. A building that I must tell you is much more handsome from the business side, the other side of the street, but realize that it's built over 13 active railroad tracks platforms. So just, you know, think about all the activity that's going on underneath that building. It's really an engineering feat. Now there's going to be a new development here where all these trees are, about 3,500 residences designed by Perkins and Will. They'll start working on it later this summer, and it'll bookend the next building, kind of surround this building, this concrete building rounded with the windows that look like eyebrows. This is called River City. It was completed in 1986, designed by Bertrand Goldberg. Now, Mr. Goldberg was an American architect who went to the Bauhaus in the late 1920s. Bauhaus was in Germany, a school that taught architects, engineers, artists, lots of different specialties. And it was headed by